May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Carol Wynn on behalf of Plaintiff's Appellants. This case is on appeal from Magistrate Judge Order granting defendant's motion for summary judgment. Plaintiffs seek a reversal of that order granting defendant's motion for summary judgment and a remand to the trial court for further proceedings in this case. This case is about three men who work side by side together for the same employers for over 10 years. From 1984 to 1993.
We've got a threshold jurisdictional issue. Perhaps you should start with that.
Defendants raised the issue that plaintiffs did not file a timely appeal because Magistrate Cole had entered a summary judgment on March 24, 2006. However, on March 26, Magistrate Judge Cole entered the final order terminating the case.
Well, there was a minute order filed on March 26th. Has a proper Rule 58 judgment ever been filed?
No, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. Under Caitlin...
I'll ask the same question of Mr. Richardson. When the district court does not comply with Rule 58... why don't lawyers tell the district court to enter a proper judgment? Then we wouldn't have these kinds of problems.
Your Honor, under Caitlin, the final order, a final appealable order, is when the case is terminated. And we offer that the case was terminated on March 26th. If the district court didn't have jurisdiction to enter that order.
This has nothing to do with the district court's jurisdiction. It has to do with our jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that. And while the district court still had jurisdiction of the case on March 26th to have entered that order, therefore, that's when the clock began running for plaintiffs to file an appeal.
Well, your notice of appeal refers to the summary judgment entered on March 24th.
Yes, Your Honor. Though plaintiffs might have stated it inartfully, what they meant... They stated that we were appealing from the judgment and the order, Your Honor, in the notice
entered March 24th.
Right.
Not March 26th.
Right.
And you filed that on April 24th, which is late.
Of course, there was no judgment on March 24th, and there was no judgment on March 26th.
Yes, Your Honor, and the federal rules allow that if a plaintiff files an appeal early, that it will be considered timely after judgment is ordered.
Well, actually, the notice springs once the judgment is entered, and there's never been a judgment entered in this case. It seems to me you should be making your argument based on Appellate Rule 4A7A little 2, but you haven't. Of course, neither has your adversary discussed what the bearing of that rule is.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll have to look at the statute.
That's the rule that tells you how long you have to appeal when the district court fails to comply with Rule 58, which is what happened here.
This case is about three men who worked side by side together.
And before you get into that, so now you know the lesson is to make sure that's filed right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, just so we don't pass that.
Definitely an important lesson. This case is about three men who worked side by side together from 1984 to 1993. They worked as instructors at the Washburn Trade School. But only one of these men, James Lovey, received a pension or pension credit for his time at the trade school from 1984 to 1993.
I don't know what the bearing of this is. There are two possibilities. Well, three. One is that he actually had a different employer. That's what the pension fund says, and so all three decisions are correct. Another is that he was not entitled to a pension, and neither are your clients. And in that event, if somebody else is getting money, it doesn't give your client any entitlement to anything. The third possibility is that all three men are entitled to pensions. And I don't see how, without the language of the pension plan in the record, we can distinguish among those three possibilities. Don't we need to compare your client's situation against the language of the pension plan?
I wholeheartedly agree, Your Honor. And
well, but there's a big problem. The pension plan is not in the record, and just to be, you know, although it's perfectly obvious, you're the plaintiff.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
And if the plaintiff doesn't put in the record something that's essential to prevail, the plaintiff loses. That's just the rule.
Your Honor, this was defendant's motion for summary judgment, and pursuant to Federal Rule Civil Procedure 56, subsection...
Yes, a defendant can move for summary judgment by saying the record is empty of the evidence the plaintiff needs to prevail. A motion for summary judgment does not oblige the defendant to submit any evidence. That's the holding of the Liberty Lobby trilogy from 1984. So defendant doesn't have to submit any evidence. It puts the plaintiff to its proof. And at that point, one would think the plaintiff has to introduce a copy of the pension plan.
Your Honor,
otherwise we can't, nothing can happen in this case.
Under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, instead of appending the actual participation agreement that's crucial to this inquiry, defendants instead filed an affidavit characterizing the participation agreement in violation of 56.
An affidavit characterizing the pension plan. If the plaintiff thinks the affidavit is incorrect, then the plaintiff puts in a copy of the pension plan.
Your Honor, plaintiffs did not have a copy of the pension plan.
Yeah, there are two ways to get it. ERISA entitles you to a copy. You apparently never asked. And apparently, at least according to the defendant, you never sought it in discovery either. Is that representation correct?
That is true, Your Honor.
Well, there we are. I don't see how the court can rule in your favor without saying, we've seen the pension plan, we know what the status of the plaintiffs is, and the plaintiffs are entitled to win under the plan.
We're seeking a reversal of defendant's motion for summary judgment. We're not seeking that our motion for summary judgment be entered in our favor, Your Honor.
Well, you're back to the proposition that somebody who moves for summary judgment assumes an evidentiary burden. As I say, that was the proposition considered and rejected in Anderson against Liberty Lobby and Celotex against Catrett back in 1984.
My understanding of those cases is that if the defendant has reached its burden of providing evidence in the record, then
there is no, the holding is that there is no burden to produce evidence. It is perfectly fine for a defendant to move for summary judgment and say, the plaintiff needed to produce evidence and didn't, therefore we win. There's no evidentiary burden associated with a motion for summary judgment. That's the holding of those cases.
Your Honor, the genuine issue of material fact that plaintiffs did raise is that Wilk and Perry were employees of Sheet Metal Workers Local 73 Apprentice and Journeyman's Training Fund, which I'll refer to as Training Fund. And that, Your Honor, the reason the pension fund gave as to why it gave pension credit to Mr. Slovey is that by virtue of his employment with the training fund. Well, that same reasoning, if applied to Wilk and Perry, which it should be, means that Wilk and Perry, as employees of the same training fund, should have contributions made on their behalf from 1984 to 1993. The genuine issue of material fact in this case is that both Wilk and Perry are employees of the same training fund, the training fund that the pension fund said was a contributing employer and thus gave contributions on behalf of Slovey. That same rationale that the pension fund gave must apply to Wilk and Perry. They, too, were employees of the same training fund. Mr. Perry submitted W-2 forms, pay stubs, all stating which he was an employee of the training fund. Thank you, Your Honors.
And let me just ask you one question to make sure I have the record clear. The defendant's statement of undisputed facts, in your response to that, they suggested that Perry wasn't covered by an agreement that required an employer to make contributions while he was at Washburn. And you admitted that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But in response, if you look at page 20 of defendant's supplemental appendix, the specific denial that plaintiffs denied, number 24, that they're actually proof that a participation agreement that covered Slovey, that alone would show that Perry and Wilk should have also received pension credit. They state at number 24, the fund has no record of any participation agreement or other agreement which obligates the Apprentice Fund to make contributions to the fund. I see that my time is up. May I finish? Thank you, Your Honor. The Apprentice, to make contributions to the fund on behalf of Perry or Wilk for their service at the City of Chicago's Washburn Trade School from 1984 through October 1983. Plaintiffs responded, deny. The agreement between the Apprentice Fund and the fund that paid in contributions to the fund on behalf of Slovey, but not for Wilk and Perry, when they are all similarly situated, is proof that the fund should have contributed to the fund on behalf of Wilk and Perry.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Richardson.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to first address the question raised about timeliness and whether there was a judgment entered by the district court or not.
Was there a Rule 58 judgment?
I believe there was, that the memorandum and opinion, the first order of March 24th, orders really that the case
is not a Rule 58 judgment. It's not even in the ballpark. An opinion granting a motion and a judgment are utterly different critters. Repeat my question. Is there a Rule 58 judgment?
Based upon your understanding of it, Judge, no.
What about the minute order?
The minute order is not an order of the court at all. It's a notice from the clerk that something has been entered into the docket.
So you're not arguing that the minute order that was entered on the same day that the magistrate judge issued his decision and order constitutes the separate judgment?
I don't believe that that's a judgment.
Okay.
I believe it's an action of the clerk. And what we have, though, under Caitlin...
Well, if you don't think that's the Rule 58 judgment, then what do you think the consequence of Rule 4A, 7A, Romanet 2 is?
Judge, I'm not familiar with that.
What it says is that if there's no Rule 58 judgment, what it says roughly is that if there's no Rule 58 judgment, the losing side has 90 days from the district court's action to appeal. And then we assume that on the 90th day, the judgment is treated as if it had been entered. And, of course, on that view, the defendant had 120 days from March 24th to appeal. Not 30, 120.
If that's... the way you see the case, Judge, then it was timely.
I'm sure I'm correctly describing Rule 4A, 7A, Romanet 2. The only question here is whether there was a Rule 58 judgment, because if there was one, then the 30 days starts from that.
I would submit it was the memorandum and opinion of March 24th.
If that's your Rule 58 judgment, no. No, it isn't.
Under Caitlin, Your Honor, the Supreme Court said that the final order...
A number one requirement of a Rule 58 judgment is that it be a separate document. It has to be separate from the court's opinion. The second requirement is that it has to state the court, has to state the relief. And the third is it has to be signed by the judge.
Yeah. I would submit that the memorandum and order did that. It was
not a separate document. The memorandum and order is not a document separate from itself. I hope we can agree on that.
I would agree.
Well, this may be a deep philosophical question, but I think we can agree that the opinion is not separate from itself.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I don't want to get lost in... I know it's an important issue of jurisdiction for you, but this is really a very simple case because it's very clear on the record that the pension plan was properly applied here. It's undisputed that the pension plan requires that in order to receive credit, there must be an agreement requiring contributions on behalf of the employee before they can get that pension credit. And it's also undisputed, as Judge Williams pointed out, that the plaintiffs admitted there's no agreement requiring contributions on their behalf. Therefore, they're not entitled to the pension they seek. The plan was applied properly, and that's all you really need to know to answer this case. We can put timeliness and everything else aside. The right answer was reached here.
So getting back to this Rule 58 problem, in the future when you have a federal case, you will make sure there's a Rule 58 judgment.
Order
entered, correct?
I will never forget, Your Honor.
Okay.
These are experiences lawyers do not forget. One other thing I'd like to point out, Judge Easterbrook, you had stated that the pension plan was not in the record. Perhaps that's semantics. The plan document is in the record, the pension plan. But what plaintiffs are referring to and what I believe you're referring to is a participation agreement, which is a contract that would require Mr. Wilk and Mr. Perry's employers to make contributions to the plan on their behalf. The plaintiffs have characterized that participation agreement as a plan document, but it's not. The plan document is in the plaintiff's supplemental appendix beginning at page 20, and like most pension plans, it's about an inch and a half thick. And that's where the rules come from that say you have to be covered by a participation agreement or a collective bargaining agreement that require contributions to the plan. And so the plan is in the record. This participation agreement, which is really like a collective bargaining agreement or a contract of employment for Mr. Slovey, is not in the record. So what we have here is undisputed evidence that there is no agreement requiring contributions for Mr. Perry and Mr. Wilk, and that there is an agreement requiring contributions for Mr. Slovey.
Is there an agreement requiring contributions for employees of the training fund?
There is an agreement that required, back in 1984, the apprentice training was conducted at Washburn Trade School, which was run by the City of Chicago. Mm-hmm. In 1993, the City of Chicago closed that school, and the Sheet Metal Union and their employers had to start their own training fund. When they did that, these men were no longer employees of the City of Chicago, and in 1993 they became employees of the training fund. From that point forward, the teachers and coordinator were covered by pensions with the local pension plan here. The dispute is over whether or not these teachers should receive pension credit for the time they worked for the City of Chicago at Washburn. Mr. Slovey did receive pension credit for that time, but when he worked for the training fund, he was not a teacher. He was the coordinator of that fund, and a decision was made to give him past service credit, but not to the teachers. And so he's in a different position. He was like the superintendent of schools. He ran the school. It was his job to set up a school when Washburn closed, hire teachers, get a school up and running from scratch. And it's not in the record, Judge, perhaps I should stop here, but as an inducement to get him to do that, he received past service credit.
Well, the reason I ask this is because there's some kind of disconnect in the admissions going back and forth in this case. So far as I understand it, there was an admission by you that both of these plaintiffs were employed by the training fund and that the training fund is a plan participant?
The training fund is a participating employer, which
participating
means it contributes
employer.
To the plan.
Right.
They were employed by the training fund from 1993 going forward.
And that's not the time period at issue?
That's correct.
Okay. So during the time period at issue, they were not employed by the training fund, which was a participating employer. They were employed by the City of Chicago?
That's correct.
Which is not a participating employer, I think?
It is not and never was. Now, you know, that fact really is immaterial, though, because during the time that these men worked for the City of Chicago, even had they been employed by the training fund, it wouldn't matter because there was no agreement that required the training fund to contribute for them.
Until later.
Until later.
Okay.
Just one other matter, Your Honors. Opposing counsel has stated there's some issue of fact, and I just want to clarify, nobody ever said there was a disputed fact in the trial court below. And I will also say that really what we have here is an attempt to open the record in the district court below to re-establish facts that the plaintiffs never sought to establish before the district court, and under cases like FDIC versus Mayer, that's just inappropriate. So we believe that the right result was reached here. The plan was properly applied. What's required is that there be an agreement requiring contributions for these men from 1984 to 93. It's undisputed that there was no agreement requiring contributions for them, and therefore the judgment was appropriate. Unless you have any other questions, and I'll pass it this time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.